This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the Collector Car Hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the future of the nation's largest temperate rainforest is at stake, and the U.S. Forest Service has managed to infuriate everybody. It's shaping up to be a major test for President Clinton. We talk green about organic farming. What's it all about, and does it make a difference? And in the Earth calendar, termites take to the wing, and their flatulence contributes to global warming. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. An environmental fight is brewing, which may lead to a green meltdown in the Clinton administration. The scrap is about a draft plan for management of the 17-million-acre Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. The forest is on the Pacific coast. It's an area where bald eagles and wolves are abundant. It's almost three times the size of Vermont and is our last temperate rainforest. Greg Petrick, conservation director of the Alaska Rainforest Campaign, an environmental organization based in Juneau, Alaska, says it's a special place.
You have to put the Tongass in perspective in the world. It is one of the most remarkable regions that you could ever visit. Spectacularly beautiful, thousands of islands with the ocean running in between them. This is an incredibly beautiful, rich place. And when I guess one of the best examples I could give of Tongass resources is being up here in the fall and watching the salmon return. And you'll watch these creeks and streams just turn totally black with big blankets of fish coming through them. And it's really a miracle in the world seeing a natural return like that. And there are thousands and thousands of salmon streams where it's repeated over this region. Remarkable resource, and every single citizen owns it.
The draft management plan has been drawn up by the U.S. Forest Service after a process which has taken years. Phil Janik, regional forester in Alaska who supervised the drafting of the plan, says he received more than 30,000 comments. The plan contains provisions which would regulate logging in various ways to protect streams and habitat, but the furor is about the amount of logging that would be permitted. Under the plan, the Forest Service would offer for sale an average of 267 million board feet of timber per year over a 10-year period. Janik explains this is far less than the 520 million board feet which are found in the current plan, and it's been in effect since 1979.
This does represent a substantial decrease, and at the same time, we believe it is responsive to the remaining timber industry in Southeast and should provide for a viable timber industry.
Since 1993, the two pulp mills in the area, as well as the sawmill in Wrangell, Alaska, have shut down because they could not meet competition from elsewhere. So even though the Forest Service is allowed to sell more, Janik says annual sales are going down and are far below what is authorized. Environmentalists are still furious. They claim the cut level should not be higher than 100 million board feet, far less than the proposed 267.
We often call upon other nations to protect their rainforests, and here we have one in the temperate zone that we are not adequately managing. And the Forest Service is simply out of control when it comes to protecting this vital resource.
That was Charles Clouston, senior policy analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council, a national environmental group. He continues,
"Well, we think that forest could withstand about 100 million board feet a year. So you can see that the Forest Service cut level is way, way too high. Last year, the Forest Service harvested only 120 million board feet, and it has been coming down in recent years. If they increase the cut again from the present level, 120, up toward 267, we won't have this resource left in the way we know it. There are many species of wildlife and fish that require this habitat, and there are still quite a few watersheds that are unroded and unentered by clear cutting. And if we can save those, we will be able to continue to have this ecosystem operate basically in its natural way. On the other hand, if they go back to cutting more and go back to the good old days of rampant cutting, as we knew in the last 30 years, then we will lose this resource, and we will just have remnants left, as we do in the Northwest and throughout the lower 48.
The chief spokesman for the timber industry, Jack Phelps, executive director of the Alaska Forest Association, takes a contrary view. He says the proposed cut level is too low to maintain an integrated forest industry in southeast Alaska.
We've said for several months that it looks that we have to have somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 million feet on an annual basis, but that's of actual harvest. And therefore, the Forest Service's number is a bit misleading. When they say 267, that, first of all, is a maximum, and that's total harvest, including pulp logs. And then they go on to say that under current conditions, only about 200 or 215 or 20 of that would be economic to harvest at this time. And then when you stack in the restrictions on land use that are built into the plan, we think it drives the actual harvestable number well below 200 million feet.
The industry says it can't survive unless the cut is 300 million board feet a year. Environmentalists say there is no real market, and the Forest Service is artificially trying to create one and justify a cut that's too high. Again, Greg Petrick from the Alaska Rainforest Campaign.
Right now, the way that we see it is it's the Forest Service bureaucracy has been built on its timber division, and it's pretty hard to break from that. And so they're basically inflating the projected cut without having demand for it, which we're not very happy about at all.
While the environmentalists and the timber industry fight it out with the Forest Service, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens and Alaska Congressman Don Young have, over the last couple of years, introduced 14 different bills or riders and pending legislation to raise the Tongass cut level. None of these have gone anywhere, in part because of threatened vetoes by President Clinton. While Tongass legislation has not reached the president's desk, the proposed Tongass plan probably will. In fact, Jack Phelps from the forest industry says the problem with the plan is that the White House has been involved already.
And quite frankly, I have very good evidence, including some personal conversations I had with some people very close to the White House, that indicate to me that the Council on Environmental Quality, Katie McGinty, and the Gore side of the White House has been intimately involved in this process all the way through. And quite frankly, that's probably the biggest thing that's wrong with it. If they'd let the professional foresters and the Forest Service write the plan, we'd have had a much more workable plan than what we ended up with.
Clusen from the Natural Resources Defense Council thinks further intervention is the only hope.
Well, this whole issue now really moves to the Clinton administration. The Forest Service, this rogue out-of-control agency, has now done their bit, and there are appeal opportunities first to the chief and then to the Secretary of Agriculture. I think these will likely be pursued, and this issue now really goes squarely to the Clinton administration, to the Vice President, to the President. Vice President Gore, in his debate last October, mentioned the Tongass, saying it was important to be saved. The president has taken credit, rightfully so, for turning back the assaults by the Alaska delegation. But now their own Forest Service is doing the wrong thing, and so the question is, will the Clinton administration stand up and turn around its own Forest Service so that this grand national forest is saved.
The only thing that seems clear as the Tongass battle rages is that nobody agrees with anybody else on anything. I'm Peter Burley. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about organic farming, and that, of course, has to do with pesticides and herbicides and chemicals on the land and in your food. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and our email address is green@amc.org. I have three guests today. Grace Gershuni, who is nationally known in the alternative agriculture movement, she developed the first organic certification program for the Northeast Organic Farming Association and was founding member of the Organic Trade Association. Recently, she spent 2 years in Washington working on developing the USDA's National Organic Program. Diane Bowen is executive director of the California Certified Organic Farmers. California is a state that has the oldest organic certification in the country, and Diane is also a member of the board of directors of the Organic Trade Association, which represents the interests of North American organic industry. And Joel Salatin, he's a full-time farmer in Swope, Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley. He's a third-generation alternative farmer, frequently addresses issues about environmental, agricultural, and the building of consumer-producer relationships, and most importantly, we've dragged him off his tractor on a beautiful hay day to join us. So, let's start with you, Grace. What is organic farming? What's it all about?
It's a way of producing food and other crops, not necessarily food, cotton, for example, that works with natural cycles and that uses things like green manures and cover crops and compost and
as an alternative to chemical applications.
Yeah.
And Diane Bowen, you are in the business of certifying folk as organic farmers in California. What does it take to get certified as an organic farmer in your state?
In our state, it is not required under our California state law, but many farmers choose to do it on a voluntary basis to show their consumers a good faith effort to verify that their farm has practiced organic practices.
So if a farm is certified, does their produce or their product then bear some kind of a certified label on it?
It does. They are inspected annually by our organization, in our case.
And what do you look for on the farm?
They keep a lot of records, and our examiners examine those records. And we look for evidence that they have a farm plan, that they understand organic farming, and they know how to farm it organically for their particular crop. We ask them to keep extensive records of all of their inputs they do on their farming, as well as their farming practices. And we also do physically inspect the farm just to verify what they've told us in the farm plan as the ways they are farming.
And Joel Salatin, as a farmer, does any of this certification stuff make any sense?
Well, I see that I'm going to be the maverick on this program.
You're the guy that's out there growing this stuff.
And that's pretty normal, I guess. I've been fairly outspoken, being fairly opposed to certification. I certainly don't mind anybody becoming involved. I do mind not being able to even call myself an organic farmer when we've been doing this for, 35 years. So we don't use the O word here.
Now, that's because you do certain things that the certifiers disapprove of, or?
No, it's simply because we're not certified. We
right.
have not submitted ourselves to the kind of extensive record keeping, physical inspection, farm planning, and all of the, the...
Yeah, you're talking about the paperwork now. In terms of what you put in the soil and what you put on your crops, would you qualify, do you think?
Absolutely.
We'd
qualify as good as anybody.
Mm-hmm. I visited his farm, and I would definitely agree with that from what I saw.
So, Joel, your concern is for want of a better word, the bureaucracy that goes with certification rather than the requirements for producing organic food and
well,
crops?
Well, my concern goes way beyond the bureaucracy. My concern is, and of course, Diane will agree, and as well as Grace, that both of them involved with the Organic Trade Association. I think anyone involved in the movement would understand that the certification effort has sprung from marketing efforts. And, you know, the idea to be consistent, to have a consistently labeled product, and to protect that in the marketplace. However, most of us also see the need for developing closer ties between producer and consumer. We talk a lot about community and sustainable, you know, rural community and infrastructure and that sort of thing. And I believe that the certification effort continues to keep the consumer, illiterate?
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you now, and let's go to the phones. We're talking Green on the Environment Show about organic farming. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we want to hear from you. I'm going to go to Peter in Vermont. Peter, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
We have, we're a diversified farm here. We're an organic dairy farm. We direct sell beef much in the same way Joel does, direct to consumers, and we also produce sauerkraut. First of all, everything we're talking about here, if what we're talking about is natural farming, is an oxymoron because nature doesn't farm. Farming is the intentional concentration of food production. Mm-hmm. So anything that we're talking about is inherently unnatural. As organic farmers, we're somewhere on the side of trying to create biological systems that imitate natural systems as closely as possible. But it's hard to draw a line in the sand and say exactly what it is. In terms of organic certification, we're certified by the Vermont Organic Farmers Association. So you can I can mail you a little book that says what the standards are that we are supposed to comply with in order to sell organic beef. In terms of our beef market, the certification is not so much an issue because we meet the consumer face-to-face. They buy it by the half or the quarter. They come out to the farm.
Sure. And they're concerned, I assume, about growth hormones and other kinds of things you might feed the beef or you don't feed the animal.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, basically, our beef are fed, you know, the milk from their mamas and grass their whole lives. They're ruminant livestock, which means they have four stomachs, which means they're designed to eat grass. Most of the beef in this country is fed. In fact, 70% of the grain grown in this country, which causes so much pollution and is basically responsible for the Mississippi Delta being down there, 70% of that grain goes to feed livestock.
Okay.
Much of it ruminant animals who should be eating grass, not grain.
Fair enough. Okay, thanks for your comment. And let's go to the phones again. Again, back to Vermont. Caleb, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
Good afternoon. I had a couple comments. One, perhaps, about Joel's comment about consumers going right to the farm. I'm a certified organic beef farmer, and I just don't expect all the consumers I have that are going to make it here. I'm being fairly realistic about it. I sell all over the state, and the certification program is allowing people to realize. I would say the certification would allow people to realize that my product is different from other products.
And if they all showed up at the farm at once, you'd never get anything done either, I guess.
The other thing is, and you mentioned this earlier, there is a problem with beef in that we are not allowed to let people know that our beef is certified.
Right.
The federal government refuses to allow us an organic sticker on any meat product.
Grace Gershuni, what's that all about?
Well, that is a holdover from the Food Safety and Inspection Service, which which has responsibility for meat and poultry products. And they have refused to permit a certified organic label on meat and poultry products until there is an organic program that comes out of USDA. Which
And is that going to happen in the foreseeable future?
I believe it is. We are nearing the point where the rule will be published as a proposed rule.
So, Caleb, tell me, you sell it as organic, but you can't say it's certified organic. Is that it?
We get around it by saying that we're a certified organic farm.
I see.
We can't even mention, even at the point of purchase, that we're
right.
a certified organic
so
farm.
So you're selling beef
meat.
From a certified organic farm.
Right.
Organic is an agricultural production system. It is not about necessarily about testing residues on one's food. We hope that the people who buy organic food are supporting farmers who are trying to create a different kind of agriculture in this country, a kind that emphasizes the principles of biology and ecology and, you know, does try to move toward from a chemical model to a model of farming more or less with the natural systems or mimicking the natural systems. That's what we're hoping, that those who support farmers, and everybody does that, every time a purchase is made, you're supporting a particular type of agriculture.
Okay.
We know consumers will vote their dollars for the an environmental farming model.
I think that says it well. Unfortunately, our time is up. So I want to thank you all. We've been talking green on the Environment Show. We'd like to hear from you. We've been talking about organic farming. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests have been Grace Gershuni from the Organic Trade Association and Northeast Organic Farming Association, Diane Bowen, who is with California Certified Organic Farmers, and Joel Salatin, a full-time farmer at Swope, Virginia, who is off his farm for a moment to join us. Thank you again. My name is Peter Burley, and I'm your host. We've been talking green on the Environment Show. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Termites are feared animals. There's more of them in mass than almost any other creature on Earth, and they'll eat your home out from under you. Environment Show's Thomas Lally reports.
All around the Northern Hemisphere this time of year, animals and plants of all kinds take advantage of the weather. For some termites, that means leaving their colonies and taking to the air.
Well, right now we're probably in places at least that are having sort of warm, seasonally mild rains would be flights of winged termites. This is the dispersal time for termites when they establish new colonies.
Lynn Kimsey is a professor of entomology at the University of California at Davis. She says when the conditions are right, termite colonies will produce a large number of sexually active termites, which are equipped with wings. They send them out hoping to meet other termites. I asked Kimsey how many get to mate.
Oh, probably a tiny fraction. That's good for us, I would say. But most birds and mice and things like this will eat termites given any chance at all. They are very tender and a very good food source. So predation takes a heavy toll on these winged individuals.
Yeah, I've noticed they're not particularly good flyers.
No, they're not good at all. And that's why they need ideal conditions.
Once the termites have found a home, they begin constructing a new colony. That could be just about anywhere with a steady supply of wood, like your home. Kimsey calls termites master engineers. In Australia, some termite colonies are a story and a half high and can last hundreds of years. They're built with soil and termite saliva, which is so strong, people there use it for their own buildings. Termites have learned these skills over hundreds of millions of years. Kimsey says they've lasted so long because they do what few other animals can, survive on wood, which isn't very nutritious. She says they do this with a little help from a friend.
They're single-celled organisms that live in special organs inside termites. These organisms cannot live without the termites, and the termites cannot live without them. So in a way, it's a symbiotic relationship like you see in lichen and in corals. And the termite takes in the bulk food, and these little microbes that they have inside of them help produce vitamins and micronutrients from the wood that the termites require. These microbes also help the termite produce enormous amounts of methane gas from wood.
And what does that mean?
Well, in terms of atmospheric methane, it works out that some hefty percentage of methane in the Earth's atmosphere actually comes from termites. But it might be as much as 60%.
60% of all the methane in the world?
Yeah, in the atmosphere. Termites are like little bitty cows, and if you've ever worked behind a cow, you know that cows fart continuously, and so do termites.
Kinsey says termites build their colonies with elaborate ventilation systems to whisk away their flatulence and ensure a steady supply of fresh air. This puts methane into the atmosphere, and methane is a gas which contributes to global warming. Maybe as a strategy to combat climate change, the Environmental Protection Agency should order termites to eat less, thereby saving the atmosphere and your house with one regulation. Now that's regulatory reform. Thanks for listening. This is the Environment Show.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berling. Still ahead, ecological visionary Bill Mollison says the developing world has surpassed the West in reaching sustainability. Our ear to the ground meets folks who say the best road is no road at all. Ecosystems we don't see exist on top of the forest canopy. We look at them from above with scientists on a construction crane. And two songs from legendary folk singer Woody Guthrie. His music paints a picture of the American landscape in the 30s and the 40s. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Bill Mollison is considered one of the gurus of sustainability. Now he's decided to retire from his life of traveling and devote himself to writing from his home in Australia. Mollison says he'll devote his time to further study of permaculture, a discipline he developed. Permaculture combines agriculture, energy, water quality, waste disposal, and housing into a system which works with rather than against the natural world. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally had a chance to speak with Bill Mollison on his final tour. Mollison says when he retires, he'll stop giving interviews and only communicate through his books.
You are considered one of the... Oh, I'm not sure how to put this, but the fathers of sustainability, I guess, is what some people referred you as. And that's, of course, something that we've heard, a term we've heard a great deal of over the past few years. But I'm interested in hearing how you would define that word, sustainability.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. A lot of people use that term loosely, so it's become almost meaningless. How we define it is that a sustainable system is one which, over its lifetime, produces enough energy to have built and maintained itself.
Now, when thinking about achieving sustainability, this concept, what is or are the most important impediments to achieving this state?
Well, I think, in short, government policies. Policies in all countries, and don't ask me why, urge farmers to get larger and to export crop. And that is simply not sustainable because we're lucky to get an energy equivalent at the gate. And if we have to export it, then we lose all those advantages. And it's only in Asia I find that governments are convening domestic security, food security conferences. So... which I attended in Vietnam. And they're very concerned that each household grows its food, has clean water, and has sufficient nutrition from the food. But the Western governments seem to have abandoned that idea altogether. And I think nutrition levels are really falling in the West as distant food sources are tapped, and a lot of the food produced in America is starch, and that's exported, and the net protein importers.
Now, there's an article this month in the Atlantic Monthly here in the States, and it's certainly a concept that has been reiterated by many economists, and that is that, well, those who say that that starvation is on the horizon if we don't change our ways, and that food we'll run into food shortages and those sort of things, they always bring up the Malthusian label and point to statistics showing that yields have grown, and with biotechnology we'll be able to increase our yields, and that essentially technology will get us out of the fixes that environmentalists are worried about. Do you have that kind of hope, or what is your perspective on faith in biotechnology and other technological fixes?
Well, I can't think of one that's been applied that hasn't got us into more trouble than it's got us out of. Most of the technologies of the Green Revolution are being abandoned in India and now totally in Indonesia also. And they've gone back to traditional organic methods for increased yield. But the main reason they did that is that their soils were collapsing under the high fertilizer inputs, and that they'd lost control of pests because the biocides used had killed a lot of the predators that they had in the fields before the Green Revolution. So the farmers are marching away from the Green Revolution as fast as possible because of the troubles caused by the pesticides and herbicides and the artificial fertilizers. And as India is abandoning the Green Revolution, Africa is being introduced to it. But I have a feeling that the Green Revolution works only for people who are administering it on very high salaries, and that it doesn't work for farmers at all.
If it's possible, I'd like you to explain what permaculture is, because that is the focus, at least that is what I know of your work.
I think your first definition that you gave me, that it's the first holistic study of sustainability with reference to buildings, infrastructure, agriculture, and human nutrition. It is just that. And what we teach is all those areas. We've gone beyond that, and we institute mini-banking. And in America, just recently, we set up the first national permaculture credit union, so that we, even in villages, we teach how to handle your finances to support the changeover to sustainable systems in the village. Because unless villages and towns get hold of their own capital, they're robbed of capital just as much as they're robbed of food by centralized banks, and who I think are merely mad adventurers, really. They're not there to support the local community, although they collect the money from it. They're there to invest in the money market or some distant and nebulous form of economy. And, of course, the other thing we do is we work sometimes exclusively with women, because both in India and Africa, they produce all the food and they have the domestic economy in their grasp. So another fault of aid agencies is not only are they male-dominated at headquarters, but they work only with men. And it's I don't know what it's like. It might be like working with horses. You're not going to get any change out of it.
And I have a question about your retirement. I just wonder what you're going to be doing with all that in your retirement. What are your plans?
Well, I count that my time is fairly valuable. I've spent the last 20 years training students right around the world, I think with the exception of Burma and Uruguay, and that I thought that was worthwhile. Till those armies got going, till those armies of teachers and armies of ground troops got going. But now I think my time is better spent in writing, so I'm going to fall back out of the public arena and the training area and lead a very much quieter life and write. My phone rings every 4 minutes at home, and I think I'm being far too much diverted from useful work by attempting to keep up with communication. And the information highway looks as though it's not only clogged, but it's full of rubbish, and it's become mainly a diversion from work.
This guy named Gene Logsdon from Ohio.
Yeah, man, I admire greatly. I think I must have every book he ever wrote.
I
hope he's listening to this program or hears about it, because he just hasn't got enough honor in his own country, I feel.
He did something for us. He wrote or read something that he wrote, and he said that he doesn't need to travel anywhere because when he walks his farm in Ohio, he walks the world, and when he farms his farm in Ohio, he does the world's work.
He's exactly right. If Americans would stay home and turn their Peace Corps inwards, not that it would do much good because you don't train the poor buggers, but if they would set up a Peace Corps which is trained inside America, that would take more work off the world than anything else, I think. I mean, we shouldn't be exporting aid to third world countries. We should be looking at the third world within ourselves.
Now, we're about to run out of tape, if your retirement is successful, then you'll never talk to me again.
No, that's right. I'll simply become as mythical as I sometimes seem to be.
Permaculture founder and author Bill Mollison. If you'd like more information about permaculture, dial toll-free 888-PERMACULTURE. That's 888-PERMACULTURE.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, the road to wilderness recovery. Wildlands Center for Preventing Roads, or Wildlands CPR, is a national coalition of grassroots organizations and individuals working to reverse the ecological impact of wildland roads. That is, roads constructed for industries like logging or mining that are on public lands.
In particular, we're looking at both preventing new road construction and excessive motorized recreation and removing those roads which are the most ecologically damaging and restoring the ecosystems which contain them.
Bethany Walder is director of Wildlands CPR. She says there are 377,000 miles of road on Forest Service land, and the destruction they cause is significant. For example, Walder says the roads fragment habitats.
If you have a road that goes through an area that used to be intact and you split it in half, then you can separate those populations from each other depending on the species. There are a lot of wildlife species that don't want to cross roads or will cross roads if they have to, but then they end up getting hit by cars or they end up subject to poaching, or the bigger problem is that they'll avoid those roads, and then that significantly reduces the amount of available habitat to them.
Walder says species that are impacted by roads include grizzly bears, elk, and many bird species that lose secure interior habitat to nest in. In addition, she says, roads completely alter water systems.
So when you build a road into a natural ecosystem, you change the way water flows, both above ground and below ground. And you also drastically increase the amount of sedimentation and runoff that goes into your stream systems. So you end up impacting species like salmon and trout and all sorts of different aquatic species that need clean running water to survive.
Walder adds, roads also allow for the introduction of diseases and exotic weeds that penetrate pristine areas.
We have a prime example here in Montana of a disease of a weed called tansy ragwort that was brought into the Flathead National Forest on logging equipment from Oregon. And that logging equipment came from Oregon, came in to do some site preparation in an area of the Flathead National Forest, and now there's an infestation of tansy ragwort in the Flathead, and it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to suppress, both with chemicals and hand-pulling, and then you have additional problems because of the chemicals that you use.
Originally called Road Ripped, Wildland CPR was formed in 1994 and is based in Missoula, Montana. It acts as a clearinghouse for information for others challenging road construction. Targeted roads around the country, Walder says, range from the Dalton Highway in Alaska, which follows the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, to a proposed overlook at Hell's Canyon in Oregon, and a huge road in West Virginia that would cross 40 streams and disturb acid mine drainage. The tactics used by Wildland CPR, Walder explains, are based on the laws that govern different land management agencies, like the National Park Service or the National Forest Service.
What we found is, especially in the National Forest, there are a number of laws that regulate how many roads are allowed on the land. And what we've done is actually gone around the country and trained people to go out and do inventories of the roads on the land and find out how many miles of road there are per square mile of land in a particular area. And then they compare that, and they go out and they actually bike on the roads and clock how many miles they are and check any closures that exist. And then they take that information and they compare it with what the land management agency says that they do have on the land. And 9 times out of 10, what we find is that there are more roads existing on the land than the agency is acknowledging in their own documents.
Wildland CPR has been successful in many ways. For example, Walder cites a landmark case on road density in the Flathead National Forest in Montana. Based on the Endangered Species Act and grizzly bear habitat, a decision was made that Flathead National Forest must remove between 650 to 1,000 miles of road to come into compliance.
Because of that, in the Northern Rockies region in particular, a lot of the national forests have reevaluated their road densities in grizzly bear habitat and are going in and are removing roads so that they can get their own areas in compliance so that they don't come under these same type of challenges.
Today, Walder says, they're fighting a proposal that seeks to ease the standards on an old statute called RS-2477. Promoted by congresspeople from Alaska and Utah, the proposal would allow for more construction of roads on public lands. At the same time, Clinton's proposed budget and several congressional initiatives are considering cutting funding for new road construction on forest lands. Federal agencies, Walder says, spend over $1 billion per year to build and maintain roads on public lands. And while the group concedes we do need roads, they say we don't need them everywhere. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Ask us an environmental question or tell us your concerns. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Leave a message and one of our producers will get back to you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can visit us anytime on the internet where you can hear the Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. A new science has developed in recent years made possible by change of perspective. By examining ecosystems from construction cranes, scientists have discovered a new world at the tops of trees. Today, so-called canopy cranes are springing up in many of the world's forests. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally spoke with David Shaw, director of the Wind River Canopy Crane deep in the forests of Washington State. The crane is a project of the University of Washington and the U.S. Forest Service.
When was the crane erected, and why was it done in the first place?
Well, the crane was erected in April of 1995. The whole premise is that limitations to access have limited our understanding. And these construction cranes are sort of the epitome of canopy access, but the most researchers are using other techniques. Like most researchers use are climbers, or they build towers or scaffolds, or use cherry pickers, or there's a wide range of techniques, and this is only one aspect of this world of canopy science. And it's, you know, just like oceanography or marine biology, it takes a specific technology to get you into the environment where the action is, and that's essentially what's going on with canopy science. And essentially, you're coming in from above to access any point in the forest without impacting any part of the forest to access it.
How different is life up in the canopy from what the majority of us experience when we walk into a forest?
There's a lot of physical aspects of the environment that are much different down below than at the treetops. Then if you think about tree reproduction and where all the seeds and trees are produced and the flowers or the cones, they tend to be in the tops of the trees. And so as a food source, many of the organisms that specialize either as pollinators or as seed feeders are living in the tops of the trees. Things are very different in the upper canopy and in the canopy than they are in the understory. Just because of all the physical factors and all the other kinds of processes that go on, and the primary one being, you know, photosynthesis and light reception by the trees is primarily going on in the mid and upper canopy, where the light intensities are greatest and where the light is really, you know, there's a lot of competition for that light.
So what is it like to be a researcher up there? I mean, what do you see when you're up there? What's the experience like?
It's just a completely different environment. And the other thing is when you are up above the forest floor, like only maybe, you know, 20 or 30 feet, and you look back down, you see the plants from the aspect of light. I mean, you see how their spatial arrangement of their foliage is actually attuned to the light environment. And when you're walking at the forest floor level, it's often hard to see that the ferns are all spread out perfectly in a very symmetric form to pick up the maximum amount of light. And the distribution of the shrubs in the stand might be related to the gaps in the forest. And it's a much, much different, it's just a completely different feeling within any forest to be up in the canopy. It's just phenomenally different, and it really changes, it's really changed my view of, you know, how I think about forests, and I tend to think much more in these three-dimensional terms now.
And what sort of things are we learning now that this science has had a little bit of time to mature?
Well, there's a couple of different ways that's been going. A lot of what we learned, particularly in the tropical forests, is about all the about biodiversity, and the many of the organisms and the biodiversity is of a forest, particularly of the tropics, is up in the canopy. That's where a lot of the action is, and that's where a lot of things that we never knew were there are there. You know, so particularly in terms of insects, they've been discovering all kinds of new insects. Every time the researchers go out and collect in tropical forests with these some of these canopy sampling techniques that's been developed over the last few years, they're discovering, you know, hundreds of new species. It's a parallel science to soil science, because we also know very little about the we know that the biotic community of soil and the tilth of the soil and it's the biota in the soil, it's the living soil which really creates a healthy forest and a healthy soil. And we're starting to understand that in the canopy too. It's the associated biota in the canopy that is affecting many of the processes of the trees. And it's these, even though they might not be a whole bunch of new species that we've never discovered before, we might have known about them, but we didn't know what their ecological process was, what their role in the forest was, and these are the kinds of things that we're really looking to.
The Environment Show's Thomas Lally speaking with David Shaw, director of the Wind River Canopy Crane, a project of the University of Washington and the U.S. Forest Service. Few artists have been as prolific as Woody Guthrie. He wrote hundreds of songs, each describing a little bit of American life. An Oklahoma native, Guthrie hit the road at age 15 and traveled the country, working at whatever jobs he could find. He returned home for school, but along the way he developed a reputation as a master storyteller and a fine folk singer. Eventually, he turned his talents into a career. In the 30s and 40s, Guthrie was considered the voice of regular, hardworking folk. We play two of his songs. The first is Pastures of Plenty, written at a time when migrants were heading to the Pacific Northwest to farm the arid lands recently irrigated by water from the Columbia River. The second is Guthrie's classic, This Land is Your Land.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is holding. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you'll see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Hey, Cisco, give me a lift up this ladder here. This thing's awful slick. I got the guitar on my back here. I can't find and pull myself up. Boy, that's roughest ladder I've ever had to climb. Okay, though. So my guitar don't get broke here. Lost my case back yonder in Redwood Forest. Well, all I got to say is it's mighty pretty country, these Redwood Forests here. Well, this land is your land, and this land is my land. From the Redwood Forest to the New York Island, Canadian mountains to the Gulf Stream waters, this land is made for you and me. East Coast, here I come.
Woody Guthrie singing This Land is Your Land. Before that, we heard Pastures of Plenty. Both songs appear on the CD Woody Guthrie, The Ash Recordings, which appears on a Smithsonian Folkways label. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 389. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.